This is the Gator Nation Football Podcast with Alan Williams and James DeVirgilio.
This place is an insane asylum in the swamp! Oh my!
Now we know we're just a bunch of average stiffs.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. What an incredible weekend in the swamp. Alan, I didn't see it coming. You didn't see it coming. What did we just witness on Saturday?
Well, I think we witnessed the Gators, as you would say, destroying Ole Miss's souls in the process. That was one of the more impressive performances I've ever seen by any Gator team. And it came out of, I wouldn't say nowhere, but when we were making our predictions, I think we thought, well, there's a chance we could win. I think the percentage of us blowing them out was pretty low. But what we saw there was a flawless victory, I would say. How did that happen, James? How did we arrive here?
I don't know. I sit here almost in stunned, speechless silence, like thinking back to my wonderful memories of the game. But obviously, we alluded to this a lot. You know, if you go back and you listen to our previous podcast, we obviously, from the beginning, have been very high on Will Grier. Will Grier, exceptional game. And we'll dive into this as the show goes on. We also talked a lot about our strengths of the team. We talked about question marks other teams had. So when you look at the culmination of it all, the reality was we said in the beginning of the year, I actually had picked this to be a win for us against Ole Miss and then flopped because I said, hey, Ole Miss has question marks. So do we. But certainly we felt like we controlled the Kentucky game. We felt like we controlled the ECU game. We felt like the Tennessee game was really weird. So in a weird way, we felt like we could have been beating these teams by more. But we somehow put together what I thought was the greatest first half in all of Gator football that I have witnessed. You know, I didn't get into UF until the year 2000. That's the year my Gator fandom really began. I've never seen a finer first half of football in my Gator life.
Yeah, almost perfect on offense and on defense. And even the special teams we were worrying about, other than a botched, you know, extra point, I mean, good kick coverage, good punt coverage, although, you know, we didn't punt that often, but everybody executed well. And I think this is the thing that I took away from the Tennessee game and the Kentucky game. We were a few moments, a few plays, a little more consistency, a little more understanding, either whether it's schematically or what each person is supposed to be doing, from playing a lot better. And they put it all together in one game. And gosh, Ole Miss looked like they didn't even belong on the same field. We were crushing them.
Yeah, and maybe they don't, because I think if you play the game 10 times now, it's hard not to think that we win that game 8 or 9 or even 10 times out of 10. I mean, they were vastly inferior, and some fun notes from the game is Will Grier had such a good first half. He's the first Gator quarterback since Chris Leak in 2005 to throw for 4 touchdown passes, which is up there. You know, it's been 10 years. And it's the first time, and this stat's going to really surprise you, it's the first time since 1999 that we have beaten a team ranked as highly as Ole Miss in the swamp. And 1999 was the game we played, obviously, like we mentioned earlier, against Tennessee. So it's kind of funny how these things are wrapping in together.
Yeah.
This team really accomplished something. It's, you know, a 5-0 start, which doesn't happen that often either. If you look as a Gator fan, we're not 5-0 all that often. You know, McElwain had done something that no other Gator coach has done, which is go 5-0 in his first year. So just a lot of amazing things happened on Saturday.
For sure. And impressive on every level. Let's talk a little bit about how the Gators were actually able to accomplish this. Maybe some of the nuts and bolts. Talked about the execution on offense. Defensively, what did we do that allowed us to shut them down so thoroughly?
I thought mainly we got incredible pressure with our defensive front four. We actually didn't have to blitz a lot. And you just kind of found yourself in the beginning of the game thinking that we knew the snap count. I think we probably did. You know, this hasn't been confirmed, but we jumped off sides a few times as the game went on, which I think was sort of a tip of the hat to that the line was jumping the snap count. You and I talked in the stadium that as the game's going on, you know, if you run a spread option offense, you run a Chip Kelly style, no huddle, very quick offense, your audible calls and your line calls are very simple. You don't have a very complicated cadence.
Because you're trying to go fast.
And I think we were onto something. I think our film study during the week must have been absolutely incredible because, I mean, all four guys were just getting in every single time. And we played fantastic at the linebacker spot. I thought Morrison really stepped up his game. We've been kind of dogging him as this year went on. Our safeties didn't really even have to do a whole lot. And I loved how we continued to put Marcus May on the line. We talked about that. We said, hey, look, I think we found something with Marcus May playing really close to the line of scrimmage. And he did. He spent most of the game as either a nickelback or a guy that was within 5 to 6 yards of the line of scrimmage, just wreaking havoc. The guy really has a knack for that. So defensively, we said last week on the podcast, I said we needed to hold them to less than 350 yards. You know, really with 7 or 8 minutes left in the game, they were at less than 275. Picked up some garbage yards to finish with 328. And the defense played like we needed them to play. We needed them to be the strength of our team. And the offense, of course, played incredible. But the defense really played lights out. And that's what both of us said had to happen. What were some of your thoughts as to how we were able to execute this and win this game?
So we kind of alluded to this last week, but and we didn't, I don't know if we maybe believed it, but the style of offense they run, that kind of spread, tempo, they're not great at just handing the ball off and running down your throat, kind of plays into our hands and our strengths. Where we want to run that nickel, 5 defensive backs, and we were able to really own them at the line of scrimmage with just our front four, like you said. Now, they're missing some offensive linemen. That really helped us. You know, no Laramie Tunsil there, all everything, left tackle. And they couldn't get anything going. I mean, McAllister, Bullard, every single one of these guys was living in the backfield. They played phenomenally well. And so a team like Ole Miss, who, when I say tempo, they want to get up to line, run a play, get on this roll like you might see Oregon do. But they had so many negative plays. They were always behind on down and distance. They couldn't keep rolling. They had to stop, regroup. What are we doing here? And I think the fact that we got so much pressure, so many tackles for loss, so many sacks, you know, incompletions on first down because they were pressured, that never allowed them to get rolling. So great job by defense. And I think it helped that Ole Miss, you know, couldn't turn the corner and, you know, try to run the ball at us and run us out of that nickel.
Yeah, and they really had a nightmare start. I mean, they seemed inadequately prepared for the environment they were going to walk into. And I have certainly been someone over the years that has really played down the Swamp's appeal and power. You know, I felt like it's just gone downhill in the past 5, 6, 7, even 8 years, really. Even during the end of the Urban Meyer years, it really wasn't necessarily a hostile place to play. I thought all that changed, and I know we'll talk more about that as this show goes on, but they were not ready for it. They weren't going with a silent snap count, which blew my mind. I remember watching the first drive and thinking, I can't believe that Chad Kelly is on the line verbally audibling to each individual lineman. Mm-hmm. And I know Hugh Freeze said after the game that they were not ready for the environment. He mentioned the environment at least 6 times in his presser. And they weren't ready for that. I guess they thought playing at Alabama would prepare them for playing at Florida, and it was clear that they just were not ready, which I think really played into our hand. Of course, they gave us a gift of a fumble in the second drive, which we then capitalized on. We talked a lot about not having cheap points last week. Now, you know, we got no cheap points from us. However, we took cheap points from them.
Yes,
and that was great. I mean, that short field, you know, they constantly had to go all the way down the field with our solid special teams, which was a great improvement from the week before. And we just made it really impossible for them to win that game. They would have had to continually drive all the way down the field to get their points in an environment they weren't ready for. And they couldn't, you know, they couldn't really even get their all-world receiver going in the game. And he wasn't even really guarded by Vernon Hargraves too often. They just couldn't even get on the ball.
Yeah, interesting that the coaches did that. We looked at this over and over again. Vern was rarely opposite Treadwell. It seemed like they tried to move Treadwell opposite of Vern. And they just... we played our corners on sides, you know, like Vern's going to play the left and whoever else is going to play the right. And I think what their thought was potentially, you know, let's bracket Treadwell and let's leave Vern one-on-one on the other guy and let him handle his business. And they did that really well. So we talked a lot about the defense. They did really well, especially that goal line stand. That was incredible. You know, in the beginning of the second half where the, you know, cool, Ole Miss, we'll give you a field goal if you want to take 10 minutes to drive down. We saw them execute. And the thing that we've been talking about a bunch is tackling. And much improved from the defense here. I don't know if this is a one-week aberration, but they tackled really well for the most part. And a guy, like you said, Antonio Morrison, who seemed not his normal self. Like, if he got caught out in space, he looked at a loss. You saw that Dobbs, you know, spin move on him last week that left him looking foolish. And I got to give the guy credit. He played incredibly well. He was in the right spot, you know, filling gaps, making sure tackles. So that was a big improvement for us too.
Huge improvement. I thought it was his best game as a Gator, and the defense, obviously, it was one of the best performances I've seen in a long time. They were utterly dominant. Ole Miss did wind up having a lot of yards on the stat sheet. They wound up having a similar time of possession to us. But that was really more indicative of the fact that they had a long field and they sucked up all the clock in the second half, which is exactly what you want to do with a lead. And that's one of the things that we should talk about is the coaching differences that came out of this game. We had a big lead. I know that 25-0, I still thought to myself, this is interesting. We could still collapse. We are a really young team in the second half, and I really wanted to watch how we would call plays. And true to McElwain's nature, we stayed very balanced. Yeah, we ran the ball, but we actually threw as many passes as we did runs until the game was really over late in the fourth. We threw a deep ball to Fullwood that should have really been completed, and that was a very aggressive play call at that time. And I think you saw that Ole Miss really never had a clue what we were running on offense. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Will Greer can complete any pass he wants on the field. He threw some of the best passes I've seen a Gator quarterback throw in a long time, and he throws the ball on time. The pass to Brandon Powell sticks out in my mind. If you watch that on film, there's a very small window there. There's a linebacker sliding underneath. You've got a nickelback covering Powell. If Will Greer does not throw that ball at that exact moment, it's incomplete. If he throws it a step later, it could be a pick. But because he throws it right then, Powell catches this ball, and the next thing you know, it's a touchdown. And Greer did that countless times in that game where he's hitting guys right when they're coming out of their break. And that speaks to McElwain's attention to detail. It speaks to how well he's teaching these players to have attention to detail. And the biggest thing for me, of like create a 30,000-foot view impression, is for the past 5 years as Gator fans, we've come to believe that our team won't improve. They've sort of been the same team throughout the entire year. And one of the most shocking things about this, probably for all of us, is that we were there at the game on Saturday and there was drastic improvement. And we're not used to seeing that. We're just not used to seeing our teams get better. And that's the most encouraging thing, is we are getting better each and every week. Will we play this way every week? I doubt it. You can't be that high all the time. But certainly my big takeaway is that the coaching is not only making a difference, but it's making a huge difference. And that is the hallmark of any good football coaches. They get more out of their players from week to week. Things get cleaned up. Things get better. The quarterback gets better. And that was all on display in the Swamp on both sides of the ball.
Agreed, and I think you hit right on it with the second half. Thought that was handled almost perfectly. Ole Miss made some mistakes that allow us to not have to deal with some potential situations, but just some smart things like let's run some more of the clock out of every possession, but we're still going to be aggressive and throw the ball. We're not going to just sit on this lead. You know, someone made the comment, you know, not to keep, you know, kicking Muschamp while he's down, but it's like when we got that 13-0 lead, it's like, well, that's good enough. Let's sit on this and try to hold on to it. And, you know, we stayed very aggressive in the first half and the second half. You talked about Greer. I love the way we talked about him being decisive and confident. He looked fantastic. And a guy we've really, you know, kind of been harsh on in this podcast is DeMarcus Robinson. He looked phenomenal. This is the guy we want to see making plays down the field, making difficult catches, using his large frame to shield people. Had some really big plays for this offense. So talk about him and maybe your favorite position group, the tight ends.
Yeah, huge, huge plays from DeMarcus. He still continues to dance around, which will continue to drive me and McElwain crazy each week. I love how McElwain will always call him out on that. I think right after the game ended, they asked him about him, and he mentioned the same thing. Hey, you know, if we can get him to run north-south, things will be great. But all in all, I felt like he finished all of his routes. Yeah. We talked a lot about that. That game, he finished every route. Obviously, what I think is going to be a highlight in all of our minds now is Greer with, you know, again, the all-world Kimdichie taking him to the turf, throwing this incredible pass to a guy who didn't quit on his route. Robinson in the Tennessee game, he probably stops halfway through that route, and he's not there to catch that pass. And in this one, he charged all the way through it, made the catch. So he was fantastic. I think he will clean up his bubble screen running. Of course, he does great things, but I think if he learns to make one move and then go, it will be better. And that was vast improvement. The tight ends, we've talked about it and talked about it. I love the tight end position. It is my favorite schematic advantage in the offense. There's a reason why Belichick of the NFL loves it. I love that we are utilizing it the way that we are.
Big game from Jake McGee.
Huge game from Jake McGee. It's easy, easy throws for Will Greer. We had a third down in our own end early in the game that we hit to Goolsby, and it's simple, simple throws. They motion him across the line. They wind up having him on a linebacker. It's just a great matchup you can win all over the field. And McGee obviously catches every single ball thrown to him. I mean, the guy's
big
hands.
Big downs, third downs, everything.
The guy's hands are like stick 'em. Just we are very dangerous because you can never know what we're going to do. I mean, put yourself in the mind of a defensive coordinator, and you have Brandon Powell who gets motioned out into the slot. You also then in front of him are going to have any combination of any one of our receivers. Could be Robinson, could be Fullwood, could be Callaway. And then couple that with the fact that on either end of the line, you're going to have either Jake McGee or Goolsby. And think of how you're going to defend that. What are you going to do? I mean, you have to wind up being spread out. You have to wind up playing a lot of nickel. And we're looking for the one advantage that we have on you, and a lot of it's generated by motion. We don't just simply line up and snap the ball. We start in one formation, motion over to another one, and we expose your weakness. And Will Greer is just pulling the trigger to the right guy virtually every single time. And you just don't see freshmen display that kind of football IQ. We've talked about it a lot. It makes me really excited to see it happening because it wasn't necessarily obvious to everyone at the beginning. So we could go on and on and on about that. But ultimately, the one thing that really allowed this to happen on the offense was the play of the offensive line.
We've tracked this unit's growth each week, and I just want to say I'm shocked at how well they played against a really talented front four from Ole Miss. I don't remember Will being in pressure all that often, like maybe just a handful of plays. And those guys did so well. And Will did a great job of maybe hanging in just 1 second longer and not running as what McElwain wanted him to do. Those guys gave him the time he needed. Even, you know, I had visions of Kim Dichi slashing through our offensive line and just breaking up, you know, handoffs and like sacking Will and, you know, tackles for loss. And we really kept him at bay. You didn't hear his name called that often. Those guys did. They deserve all the credit this week. We played a bunch of different guys up front, and they all did really well. I can't say enough about how pleased I am with their development. I mean, someone mentioned our position coach Summers, you know, the offensive line coach, and what a phenomenal job of taking just a hot mess of a unit and turning them into something that, you know, can be set up against, you know, a top-notch defensive line and hold their own.
We're playing three freshmen on the line. We have the fourth heaviest line in either the college or the NFL landscape, which is an interesting little tidbit. So these are big boys, and they're moving their feet well. We ran some rather, and you don't really use the word exotic with O-line, but we really did run some rather exotic O-line blocking schemes that worked very well. Ole Miss blitzed us a ton. They like to blitz, and they blitzed us even more than they normally blitz. And Will Greer was doing his best Tom Brady impression. Yeah. In the NFL, you don't blitz Tom Brady. He'll murder you. He'll make you pay. That's exactly what Greer did. I mean, they didn't have enough defenders back there. So when we completed passes, they were big plays. Ole Miss hadn't allowed any plays above 20 yards. I think they allowed 5 or 6 in this game on Saturday. And none of that's possible without the O-line taking on what Ole Miss threw was a variety of blitzes. Strong side, weak side, delayed stunts. All the things that have been getting to us seemingly didn't get to us at all in this game. Which was impressive because it wasn't like we really ran the ball tremendously well. We were just effective, well enough, but it wasn't like we're gouging them to where they're worried about the run. It was rather, quote-unquote, predictable pass downs, and we were just beating them on the line of scrimmage with the offense, and we were also beating them on the line of scrimmage on the other side of the ball with the defense. All in all, like we said, it's one of the best games I've ever seen a Gator football team play. I was privileged to be there to watch it. It's really exciting for the future because our team is so young. It's almost impossible to believe that this happened. It's one of the reasons why we jump so much in the polls, right? Third largest jump in the AP poll ever, from 25 to 12 or 11, depending on which poll you're looking at. So a lot of great things are happening, obviously, in Gainesville. One of the things we talked about and should probably talk a little about now is the Swamp. What were your thoughts on the Swamp on Saturday night?
It was a fun place to be. I was so thankful that I got to be there. You know, we had seats pretty close to the field this week, and looking back, and the student section looked full. And I was a little nervous whether it would fill up. And, you know, a ton of, mistakes by Ole Miss or timeouts that the crowd caused, I think. And, you know, like you said, gave them a really difficult time. I mean, I think Vern said that it was the loudest he's ever heard the Swamp. That was a really exciting environment to be in, a place to be in. And if this can turn into a place, like you said, not just a, like, you know, kind of a difficult place to play in, but like a exceptionally hostile environment, then that's going to bode well for this team.
Yeah, I thought that it was the best Swamp atmosphere since the Steve Spurrier days. I thought it was better than the Urban days, certainly better than anything Muschamp threw out there. and better than the Zook days. It felt like a Steve Spurrier style, maybe late 90s, early 2000s swamp atmosphere. It was rowdy. People stayed late. No, the stadium wasn't full, but everyone that was there, there was just an incredible buzz in the air that has not been there in a long time. The noise was consistent. Mm-hmm. It was persistent. It drove Ole Miss crazy, and I think they probably got on the bus and got on the airplane and thought to themselves, I'm really glad I don't have to play here for a while, because I have to imagine the crowd noise was just rattling around in their brains as they tried to process what just happened to them. I mean, it was what makes the Swamp so magical. And if you couldn't be there and if you weren't in attendance, it was just a wonderful night that McElwain commented on. It was a special night, and I hope to watch it continue. As you know, we're away from the Swamp now for a while, so hopefully we have a great October here, which is going to be a gauntlet that we have to go through, and we return to the Swamp being what it once was, which just really brought a big smile to my face.
So I've talked about this being a flawless victory, but we do have a few things we probably need to work on. You know, this might be nitpicking a little bit, but if you were to look at the game and you're a coach, of course they want improvement in every game. What would you comment on as ways still for the Gators, this Gators team to improve?
I would like to improve the refereeing.
Good luck.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on this year, but I mean, two of maybe the worst no calls I've seen 25 feet away from the actual play happening, with the ref standing there looking at it, with the body slam of DeMarcus Robinson, then followed by the textbook definition of pass interference, in which neither ref even so much as reaches for the yellow hanky. So that would be something. Maybe send videos, write letters. You know, let's fix that. If the game gets close, that'll hurt us. But a few things that stood out to me are going to be the zone read. You know, we talked about it last week, and we're still not good at it.
I don't know why either. Seems like we should be.
We can't stop it. I mean, Chad Kelly, I don't know how many rushing yards he finished with in the game. I don't have the stat sheet right in front of me, but most of their damage was done on the zone read. I mean, the quarterback keeping the ball in the zone read, it's like we have no idea what we're doing. And you know, on film, it's not one thing. Occasionally, it'll be the defensive end that pinches in too much. Occasionally, it's the defensive tackle that gets too aggressive getting up the field. But it's not like it's one consistent thing. It's several things at the line that are happening. And we are being punished by the zone read. The good thing is we don't really play another zone read team per se. We play some power teams, which we're going to have to see how we do against them. But we can't stop the zone read. And nothing convinced me in this game that we could here either. We proved we could stop a spread offense that wants to pass the ball a lot. That we did. But we couldn't stop the zone read. So we're going to need to get better. They got to look at film. They got to clean that up. That's a weakness right now for us. I think other teams will probably even throw that in to try to get us because we're struggling so much. What are a few of the things you saw that we need to work on?
Well, the thing that drives me crazy with coaching philosophy was our chasing those points after we missed the first extra point. And I don't understand why we just don't pick up a few points. I know the chart says differently, but until a late game fourth quarter situation, you don't know how the game's going to go. Keep picking up the points. We lost out on two extra points because we didn't kick them. And because we were chasing that first one from the beginning. And so at that point, I would have loved for us just to go after an extra point here or there. And then this was a small thing. This didn't actually hurt us in the game, but it was disconcerting. There were a ton of bad snaps from Cameron Dillard where either Wilger had to jump for them or that maybe slowed a running play, or one that, you know, he had to recover a fumble essentially. That could have been enormous. We saw some bad snaps really hurt Ole Miss. So that's got to get cleaned up. And that's a thing that shouldn't be a common occurrence. And, you know, one bad snap every once in a while is like a human error, but he was having a really tough time getting that back there, and that's got to be cleaned up.
Yeah, the snaps, we were kind of looking at each other through the whole game, just waiting for something disastrous to happen. I imagine they'll get a whole lot of work on that in practice this week. The chart, and I want to revisit this for a moment because I love statistics, and the chart is always something that's really interesting to me because, you know, this chart was developed, I think, 25 years ago, and every NFL and college coach treats it like the gospel, and we played right into it. You know, once we got to 19, the chart says go for two. Once we get to 25, the chart says go for two. And to me, I think a better approach is to be more tactical. You keep adding points on until it's closer and you have a more defined metric. So, hey, a team's within one score. If you can get it and go for two, you can put them to two scores. You know, those sort of things, I think, make more sense. So I'm with you there. I don't get the chart when you have those kind of leads. And I think this is a little bit of a opposite side of this is when coaches have big leads, which you saw us do at the end of the game, we were playing conservative in the red zone for a field goal, which I think is very smart strategy mathematically. We kicked a field goal late in the game to go up 4 scores as opposed to trying to go for a touchdown, which still puts you up 4 scores. That makes mathematical sense. So to me, you know, they're kind of exhibiting the opposite bias. It's always fascinating. NFL coaches do it. College coaches do it. McElwain did it. I generally love aggressiveness, but I think when you have a big lead early on, you just keep pouring on points and positive momentum, and you wait until things get closer to evaluate that. So I agree with you there, and hopefully we won't be hitting the uprights on any more extra points, and maybe we won't have this problem. But, you know, Jorge made some field goals. I know they call him George Powell, but we're going to call him Jorge.
We love Jorge.
We're going to call him Jorge on this podcast. That's how I spell his name. So with that, any other thoughts on the Ole Miss game that you want to get out there that we haven't talked about?
I think this is a team that came in averaging, you know, speaking of Ole Miss, 55 points a game or something like that. And to see them absolutely shut down, I think shows the potential of our defense. And, you know, our offense finally turning the corner and putting up points against a really talented defense shows their ceiling. So that's what everyone is writing about this week, is the fact that who knows where this Florida team is going to end up. We don't know what the ceiling is for the team. So that's really exciting. I don't expect us to come out and play like this every week necessarily, but it's exciting to know that the sky is the limit. Now that I'm not now predicting us to win the national championship or anything, but it's cool to see this team improving on such a big level week to week.
What about you? Yeah. I mean, I think the same. The best thing about what we saw was that it's highly repeatable. Nothing we did in that Ole Miss game was magical or special or trick play oriented. What we did is highly repeatable. We played solid defense. We improved our tackling significantly. We called great plays on offense. We kept Ole Miss off balance. We threw consistently accurate passes. We ran really good routes. We secured the football. Those are things that can be done time and time and time again. This was not a fluke game.
No, it's not like we had like 6 turnovers and we just buried them. There was really only that 1 turnover that was significant until the very end. Like, we were up on them huge without like getting like 7 interceptions or something like that.
And that's the thing. Do we know where our ceiling is? No. But if that's our ceiling, can we win a national championship? Maybe. I mean, Ole Miss is a weird team, and that's the one caveat I want to say. I think my takeaway from the game is, as excited as I am, and I'm very excited, so much of what we've talked about has happened, so much of the tactics, McElwain's commitment to attention to detail, all these things that I have believed as we've watched unfold, you know, be reasons why coaches are successful are happening. But it's still important to know that, one, in college football, anything can happen. These are kids. And two, Ole Miss is prone to some really bad losses. Last year, they also beat Alabama, and they got waxed near the end of the year by several teams. TCU beat them 42-3. Arkansas beat them 30-0. And of course, this Ole Miss team is probably better than that team was last year in a lot of respects, but you just don't know.
Yeah.
And we haven't played a power team yet, which we're going to play. You know, we're going to play two of them pretty much back-to-back with LSU and Georgia. We have to see if we can pass that test. But in the meantime, we have Missouri on the roll this week, and they provide their own test because they've sort of been like a house of horrors for us. But before we get to that, I want to spend just a moment talking about the Gator Nation Football Podcast Twitter page. So right now, we have somewhere around 8,000 listeners, which is absolutely amazing. Alan and I love talking to you guys each week, talking with you guys about Gator football. Our Twitter page right now has like 11 followers. Now, what I'm asking is for everyone that's listening to this show to go on Twitter and to follow us. And not because we're going to post these incredible updates or things that are going to blow your mind on Twitter, but simply because it allows us to get access to all the great guests that we have. And our quote-unquote Twitter game is not very strong if Alan or I are tweeting at, you know, a famous celebrity with our 11 followers saying, hey, wait, we have 8,000 listeners. Our show is really successful, but look at our 11 followers. So if you get a moment, you can just jump onto Twitter. And you can follow us at the Gator Nation Football Podcast, which is Gator Nation FBPC. Like I said, just click follow. It's one and done. We're not going to send a bunch of stuff out on it. We're not going to try to become the world's most creative Twitter site. We are going to use it to get guests.
And better guests for you guys.
Yeah, better guests for you guys. And speaking of guests, I'm really excited about today's Gator Nation guest, which is Kiwan Ratliff. Let's bring him on the program right now.
All right, we are joined now on the program. Very happy to have Kiwan Ratliff, former Gators corner from 2000-2003. He was an All-American in 2003 and was also the SEC Defensive Player of the Year. Thanks so much for being on today.
I appreciate you for having me.
So, Kiwan, let's jump right in. We know that you work a lot with personnel. We know that you have a 7-on-7 team, and you can certainly tell us a little bit about that as far as what you're doing now. We know that because of that, you have a pretty good idea of what the program is looking for with regards to the talent they're recruiting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, as far as the talent-wise, I mean, I think that's pretty much the same no matter what year, no matter what coach you go through. Every year, the coach is looking for the best talent throughout the state of Florida. That's your homegrown talent. That's the one where you want to stake a claim in, and you want to be able to go down south and get those guys. You want to be out in the central Florida area. You want to be in north Florida area. If you can just get, as I say, 80 to 90% of your recruiting class from here in the state of Florida, then I'm pretty sure you have a great class with a lot of great talent.
What specifically, and I know some of the guys you've worked with, who are some of those guys that are on the team now that you specifically spent time working with in the past couple of years?
Well, in high school, I was fortunate enough to have in the same secondary as two of our safeties, Keanu Neal and Marcel Harris. They were two guys that came and played with us at the Rat Pack. We had Duke Dawson that came and played with us. I've known Nick Washington since he was probably in eighth or ninth grade because he was playing with Gus Scott down at Trinity Christian in Jacksonville, which was my roommate in college. A few of the other guys, you know, like Vernon, we would see Vernon at all the tournaments, and I got a pretty good relationship with his dad built when he was over at USF because he was recruiting a lot of the guys. So just throughout the 7-on-7 tournaments and the 7-on-7 thing that's going on now and is catching on pretty big, you get a chance to bond with a lot of those guys like the Quincy Wilson. Me and his dad have become pretty good friends just by watching Quincy over the years at 7-on-7 and then becoming friends with his dad.
So looking back to the game on Saturday, which was obviously great for any Gator fan, any Gator player, what did we do on defense, or what are we doing on defense essentially that's working so well right now with regards to a lot of the guys you mentioned? You know, Neal certainly had a huge hit in that game. The whole secondary played really well. What are we doing strategically that's working for us right now?
Well, I think the main thing that's working in our favor right now is the multi-fronts that we're running and the multi-coverages that we're running. With Coach Muschamp, Coach Muschamp is a great defensive coordinator. A defensive mind, I should say. I would never try to take anything away from him and Coach Durkin and a lot of those other guys that were here with that staff. But with this staff and Coach Collins, what he's doing a lot is mixing up coverages. He's mixing up front. He's mixing up the look for the quarterback so that the quarterback doesn't come out of the huddle and with his pre-snap read, know exactly what everyone is doing. One play you may come out and see press man. Another play you may come out and see cover three. Then you may come out and see a double high safety. So it's all with the same front, all with the same alignments initially. And on the snap, everybody's moving to different locations and doing different things. Now it's forcing those guys to think and not play as fast as they could if they knew exactly where we would be every time.
And so it looks like our base alignment generally, right, is some sort of nickel cover two or even a dime at some point in times cover two, but mainly a nickel with either Tabor or Marcus May playing down low. And then, like you said, there's been a lot of variation post-snap to where we're confusing the corners. And I saw at the end of the game last week, Tabor was playing a lot of like free nickel in the middle of the field, which is interesting. And so do you think we're going to continue to see innovation as we go on, as the year goes on, or have we pretty much done everything creatively we're going to do and we're going to continue on in that sort of same vein?
Well, I mean, I think it's on a game-by-game basis. Against Ole Miss, they were pretty much dominant 11 personnel or three wide receiver personnel, one running back type of personnel where they were putting a lot of wide receivers on the field, which gives you a lot more flexibility with those defensive backs. And with us having so many injuries and the lack of depth at linebacker, I think that kind of played into our personnel's hands with them being a passing team. But if you go against a team like Georgia or an LSU, I'm pretty sure that front, the schemes, everything will be a little bit different because those guys come out in 22 personnel, which will two tight ends and two running back sets a lot with a fullback in the game, bigger bodies in the game, whereas we, like you said, we're playing predominantly nickel right now. But in games like that, you don't want to have 5 or 6 DBs on the field when there's only 1 or 2 wide receivers. So I think you can pretty much say that on a game-by-game basis, the personnel would change on the defense, so the schemes and the techniques and the assignments would change as well.
So we have a lot of high-profile defensive backs on this team, most notably Vernon Hargraves III, but also Quincy Wilson and Jalen Tabor. Can you talk for a minute and just what makes them special? Like, why are they good at what they're doing?
Well, I believe that Vernon is so special because Vernon had the technique that it requires to be a great college corner or a great NFL corner or a great corner, period, at such a young age. I can remember seeing him play as a sophomore in high school and him staying square at the line, him, you know, no false steps, no crossover steps. Just small things that most DBs don't learn until you get to maybe your junior, senior year of college, if you learn it at all in college. And he was doing those types of things as a second-year high school player. So just things like that for a guy like Vernon is what sets him apart. Guy like Quincy, his size stands out to you from the first time you see him. I mean, he's easily, I'd say probably 6'1", 205. And he moves like a 5'10", 180-pound corner. He's not afraid to hit you. He'll come up and mix it up with you. He can move inside in the slot. He can play outside. To play multiple positions, and he can cover. So that makes him a hard matchup for most wide receivers. And then Jalen is just one of those guys that you draw up as a corner. If you were playing Madden and you were creating your guy, your players, or college football or any of that, you want that corner with long limbs that can have great ball skills, that can run and thinks the game. And that's exactly what Jalen does. So in those three guys, you have three interchangeable pieces that can move inside, outside, cover big wide receivers, small wide receivers, and none of them are afraid to hit.
So if you were the opposing coach and you were going to attack our defensive backs, have you picked up any weaknesses on film or in practice or things that you say, you know, this is where we probably still need to improve?
Well, if I'm going to attack our defensive backs, first thing I'm going to do is come out and never give them what they see on film the week before. I mean, because the way these guys are studying film and the way these guys are – jumping on your number one, your number two favorite routes, I mean, that's showing that they're students of the game. So anytime you're attacking guys that are students of the game, you want to attack them and show them things that they've seen on film and have a counterpunch with it. So, I mean, that's something that's obvious that most offensive coordinators try to do anyway, but that's probably the only way you can attack them because right now if you come out doing something that you've been doing all year, those guys are just physically too good and mentally too good for you to repeat yourself.
Now, Kiwan, we know that during your time in the Swamp, you had a whole lot of interceptions. And I know watching you as a player back then that you tend to have this knack to break off your coverage and read either it be a route or the quarterback, especially when we ran a lot of zone. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're looking for, what really any corner is looking for when they're going to maybe take what looks like a gamble, but in reality is a calculated risk that winds up with an interception?
Well, with me personally, I mean, I can't speak for those guys, but for me personally, the things that I looked for as a player were down and distance tendencies, formation tendencies, and route combination tendencies. With most coordinators, offensive coordinators, they'll come out, and if it's 2nd and 8, if you watch all their 2nd and medium to long situations throughout the season, you'll start to pick up on a pattern. Some coaches may like to go to this route if it's 2nd and 6 to 8. Some coaches may like to go to this formation if it's 3rd and medium. Some coaches may like to, you know, give you this type of motion just to see if you're a man or zone when they want to run this play. So if you can pick up on those coordinators' tendencies and on some of their habits, then a lot of times if you see it, I tell the guys that I work with all the time, don't wait till the 2nd or 3rd time you see it. The first time, trust what you've seen on tape, trust what you've seen on film, and jump at that first one because you may not get a 2nd or 3rd opportunity.
You had a lot of really great moments during your time as a Gator. Is there one in particular that stands out, maybe a favorite moment while you're in the Swamp?
Well, my favorite moment as a Gator and in the Swamp are two different things. My favorite moment in the Swamp I actually was playing against Florida State my senior year, and I know, I mean, we lost that game. I still say we won it. The refs
absolutely
took it from us.
Absolutely.
In that game, that was the first game in the Swamp where I had my mom, my dad, my grandparents, my brothers, my whole family there to watch me play in Florida. So win, lose, or draw, that was my favorite moment of all time in the Swamp. But my favorite moment as a Gator was in my junior year playing against Michigan in the Outback Bowl. Michigan was a school that I was committed to and I was leaning towards very heavily throughout high school. And to get a chance to play against them and to play against a childhood friend and Marlon Jackson was a dream come true to me, and actually catch a touchdown on Marlon in Michigan in that game was the highlight of my career, other than my defensive plays that I made.
Kiwan, that's great insight. And lastly, if you could give us a prediction for this week, and since you've obviously given us tremendous insight into some of the X's and O's, maybe a thought as well as to what kind of scheme we'll employ against a freshman quarterback on the road.
Well, I don't think the scheme will change up much. I mean, Missouri is a pass-happy offense as well. I think we'll probably blitz a little bit more, put a little bit more pressure on the young guy to try to force his hand a little bit more to get him to make some mistakes early on. But as far as the coverages and everything, I think it's pretty much going to stay the same, because if you see one team come out in 3-4 wide receiver sets and you see the different coverages and they're working, more than likely going to stay with that. And our secondary is good enough to handle that. And I believe this game, we ride that momentum from the big win that we just had against Ole Miss, and we come out with a double-digit victory.
I love it. This is Kiwan Ratliff joining us on the program today. He was obviously and still is a Gator great. Thanks so much for being on the show, Kiwan. If you want to follow him, you can get him on Twitter at Kiwan Ratliff. He predominantly spends his time now with the Rat Pack, which is a 7-on-7 football team, and also assisting players recruiting and getting recruited around the college area. Thanks again, Kiwan. It was wonderful chatting with you.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate you guys, keeping me a part of that Gator lore that's going on right now.
That was a fantastic interview with Kiwan Ratliff. I assume you agree with James.
I love talking about the X's and O's like that, and it really illustrates what it takes to be a high-level player in college, and especially in the NFL. You have to be a thinker. You have to be smart. Let's talk about the Missouri game now, though. Upcoming this Saturday, night game. Their fans will be pumped up. They've taken a bad loss to Kentucky. They've beaten South Carolina. Set the stage for us.
This screams trap game to me. This is the classic huge win. You got a big-time opponent coming up in 2 weeks, and you're going up against an opponent that has struggled this year, who isn't a big brand-name program. This is a young team who I think is going to experience a lot of up and downs this season. This game really concerns me. What about you?
Yeah, I feel like it shouldn't concern me, but it does. One, because Missouri is this weird team that keeps beating us. And I keep thinking like, oh, it's only a matter of time before Missouri goes away forever. Once Florida's good, Georgia's good, Tennessee's good, they're relegated to the basement. But that's not really true. They're going to start a freshman quarterback, and they're going to be at home. They've had our number. They still have a great defensive line that can generate a lot of pressure. So probably one of the things I'm excited about watching is how we handle another road environment. And now we have so much hype, it's going to be a pretty hyped up road environment. And how we handle another really good defensive line. This is probably the best defensive line we've faced thus far, because their defensive ends are getting so much pressure. Even though they're quote-unquote no-names right now, their production is the best we've seen. So I'm curious to see how we're going to handle that, along with the fact that it is, in fact, a trap game. What do you think about the quarterback situation?
So Matty Mock, their starter for the last couple of years, is suspended for about a month. We're not sure. So they started a true freshman, Drew Locke, last week. He played pretty well. They got the win. But I'm hopeful that we're going to give him fits. Again, I think their offense should, it's kind of similar to Mississippi a little bit, should play into our hands in terms of us playing the nickel. And if we send some pressure at him, my hope is that he's going to fold. I don't know. The whole Missouri thing feels crazy to me. We shouldn't be that scared of a team, but it is. It's been kind of a house of horrors for us, either there or at home. You know, I'm not sure how we're going to handle the hype. You know, this is like a theme. How do you handle success is a big question, with especially with a young team. And hopefully a mitigating factor in this situation is that they crushed us last year. And there's a lot of guys on the team who remember that very well. And hopefully the coaching staff will be able to point that out. Is, hey, guys, don't take this Missouri team for granted because they just blasted you last year.
I think that's in our favor as well. We've lost, 2 years in a row, right, to our last three. I think these guys have a bad taste in their mouth with regards to Missouri in general, like Gator fans do. And I'm thankful it's not an 11 a.m. kick like yes. It was the last time we played there. I think that bodes in our favor. And it's yet another stepping stone. In a weird way, we wouldn't have viewed it as a stepping stone, but here we are. We've passed this incredible test. Can you now show that you're a team that can play with consistency against a team that's not as exciting or sexy to play against as Ole Miss? So another chance for us to pass that test. Let's talk a little bit about the SEC East. It's wide open right now.
Wide open.
We're in first. We control our destiny.
We're in first. Who saw that coming?
Yeah, right? I mean, it's really fantastic. We thought we could compete for one, and now we're in first. So we control our own destiny, which is wonderful. The only teams we know are really out are Vanderbilt and South Carolina. Everyone else is alive. This game means a lot for Missouri, means a ton for us. Let's broaden the scope even further and talk about whether or not we think some of these teams are good or bad. Let's play a little contender pretender.
Let's do it.
I'm going to start with the East teams.
So this is a contender or pretender to win the SEC
title? This is to win the SEC title. Yeah. Okay. Win the SEC title. Do you think they can win, or are they going to be a flash in the pan and they'll be out by the end? Let's start with Georgia. Just got drubbed by Alabama at home. Typical Mark Wright loss. What do you get?
I still have to say they're a contender. Ton of talent. A lot of winnable games left on their schedule.
I say contender as well, even though I feel like they're the same Georgia team they always are, which means that they inevitably cannot be a contender by definition, but I'm going to say they are because somebody has to be. Missouri.
I'm going to say pretender. They've struggled insanely on offense. I mean, they put up 9 points against UConn, and I don't know. We'll see coming out this weekend, but I have to say pretender.
Yeah, pretender, 100% pretender. Freshman quarterback, other quarterback suspended, don't have the talent, transition year, pretender. We'll save us for later.
Okay.
Let's save us for later. Let's go to the West now. Let's go LSU.
Contender. I don't think they've proven it totally yet, but I have to say, did I say pretender? I mean contender. I'm great at this game. Contender.
I'm going to say pretender. I think LSU is literally a one-man team. I think they have one man, Leonard Fournette, and he's disgusting. And I think the rest of their team is below average. They have a quarterback who throws for 80 yards per game. They have a defense that's giving up points to everybody. As soon as someone can stop Fournette, which maybe they can't stop Fournette, but as soon as someone can, they're not going to win. I don't think they can win enough games against tough opponents. I'm going to say pretender. Alabama.
Contender, definitely.
100% contender. No doubt in my mind. The demise of Alabama is greatly overhyped. I fully expect them to be there by the end. Ole Miss.
I'm going to have to say pretender. They're going to be too up and down. I don't trust them in big moments yet.
Yeah, I really don't know what to do with Ole Miss. Can I put them in the tweener category? Like, wait and see? They got a big schedule coming up?
No, you
got
to tell me.
I'm going to say pretender. If they were a contender, they wouldn't have lost to us the way they did. I mean, we're certainly not an NFL team, so I'm going to have to say pretender. Texas A&M.
Oh, gosh, this is the toughest one. I like this team a lot. They're still really young. I'm going to say contender.
I'm going to say contender as well. I don't think they can maybe hang with the Bamas of the world play for play, but they win games, they're gritty, their offense is moving the ball. Someone does well under those circumstances. And last but not least, the Florida Gators.
Big time contender. Obviously first place in the SEC East. No, really, I do think the East is wide open. And if you can get to the SEC championship game, who knows?
Yeah, I say contender, and I'm really rooting for Alabama not to be the opponent that we face if we make it, which I think we are probably the best team in the East because we have a quarterback. In fact, we probably have the best quarterback in the entire SEC. And that's a big statement, but it also is indicative of how poor the quarterback play is in the
maybe
SEC.
Faint praise, actually.
But Greer's ceiling is really high. He probably shouldn't be the best right now, but I wouldn't trade him for anybody else in the SEC. So I think that gives us a big leg up. I'm going to say contender.
Okay, well, let's jump into the keys to this game. What do the Gators have to do to win?
Really, we need to have a freshman quarterback play like a freshman quarterback, and I'm not talking about Will Greer, I'm talking about Drew Locke. If we don't allow them to complete passes and they have to run the ball, they can't score. They shouldn't score. They shouldn't score more than 13 points against us. But stopping their offense isn't really the deal. That's our strength versus their weakness. It's going to be our offense. The only way Missouri is going to beat us is if they really mess up our offense. They get turnovers. We're not able to move the ball. We lose the field position battle. So if you're watching this game and you're wondering what's going to make us win or lose, all you have to do is watch our offense, watch our offensive line, watch our field position, and watch our turnovers. If those things go well, we're going to win the game rather easily.
So I think this game is going to be won or lost for us actually during preparation this week. Can these guys refocus themselves after two huge victories and gear up enough for Missouri? This is what's crazy about college football. You don't know how a team's going to respond to wins or losses. I think if we can be focused this week, I think we should handle Missouri pretty well. But yeah, the offensive line's got to play really well again. And the defense just has to, I think, continue to tackle. No big busted plays. If they can keep everything in front of them, I think we should win.
So give me your prediction. Give me the score.
All right. I think we're going to put up some points again. I'm going to say 33-13.
I like that score. We're seemingly picking the same scores like every time. I'm going to say 27, although I really feel like we could score 40. But I'm going to say 27. I'm going to give their defense some credit, and I'm going to say they get 10 on us. And I think, like I said, the thing that I know you and I will both be watching for, I know I'm definitely going to be watching for, is how we get off in the game on an early start. I think if we come out and score once or twice early on, this game is completely over. We're better than them at virtually every position. We have more talent at virtually every position, and we're riding an incredible momentum wave. So really, the start will be key, and then obviously continued progress of the offensive line. That's going to be the big thing for us to see. And like you said, how do we handle success? Everyone's talking about you now. Everyone actually thinks you're good now. How do you handle that as a player?
Making that prediction makes me so nervous to say it out loud. That big of a win, because Missouri has just haunted us. Oh, man. Okay, we'll see. In my head tells us that's what happened. In my heart, I'm super nervous to make that prediction. So let's talk to TJ Moe up next. He's a really accomplished wide receiver from Missouri. He's got a lot of interesting thoughts, I know, about this team. So let's bring him on right now.
Let's welcome to the program TJ Moe. He is a former Missouri wide receiver. He was the captain of the 2012 football team. He is now also a radio host in St. Louis, and that's where he joins us from today. TJ, welcome to the program.
Thanks, guys. How are we doing today?
All right, we're doing great. It's a sunny day in Gainesville after a big win, and I know you guys had a big win as well on Saturday. Speaking of that win, what's the state of the Missouri program right now?
Honestly, I don't think anybody really knows because of the quarterback situation and the fact that South Carolina is a very bad football team. So this is a Missouri team that beat a directional school to start the year, which I don't think anybody really counts. It's Southeast Missouri. And then going to Arkansas State, which I think they're a decent football team, but certainly not somebody you should be struggling with in the fourth quarter. And then you beat Connecticut. You lose to Kentucky, who I think is a decent football team, but certainly not really good. And then you beat South Carolina by 2 touchdowns. But it's the quarterback turmoil that everybody's talking right now. Obviously, the suspension of Matty Mock is a big deal. And we don't really know what's happening inside that locker room. That's kind of the thing that's always a question mark when you have suspensions, when you have a true freshman quarterback and a very good defense. Really, nobody really knows what the state of this team is, and I think we'll find out a lot about them after this weekend.
And speaking of Matty Mock, I just saw today that he might be suspended throughout the end of the month. Do we have any idea yet what he's done?
I don't think anybody outside the program really has. There's rumors floating around, of course, and out of respect for the program that I was a part of, I wouldn't speculate. But I don't think there's any knowledge of the situation being reported in the media. And so, yeah, I mean, I tried to tell people, I had a lot of questions on Twitter about what could get you suspended for one game initially. And I said, well, it could be just about anything, honestly. Coaches can suspend you for missing class, for missing meetings, for missing practice, for being late too many times, for it's an altercation with a teammate or a coach. Could be academic. It could be 1,000 different things, really, and anything that the coach deems plausible for a suspension is what can happen. Now, being suspended through the end of the month, that is something that maybe doesn't add up a little bit because it's not a legal matter to our knowledge. And when when it is a legal matter, the local reporters and beat writers figure it out real quick. It's always some sort of, you know, they go through the arrest or things like that. So this is some sort of internal matter, but to be suspended for a month, and we don't know that for sure. Pinkel hasn't made that announcement yet. But for a month-long suspension, there's something a little more going on than maybe what was at first led to believe.
Well, speaking of Coach Pinkel, let me ask you about him. I think he's a little bit of an enigma to most college football fans around the country. Feels like he's one of two extremes. Either he's a really underrated program builder, or he's somebody who's maybe in over his head a little bit, and I don't know which. What's your thoughts on him right now?
I don't know that he's ever been in over his head. And he built a really good program over at Toledo. I think he's the all-time winning coach over there. And certainly in Missouri, he's the all-time winning coach over here. He's got five division titles in the last 7 years. And his one thing is that he hasn't been able to win a championship game. And he's won some big games. If you guys remember back to 2007, the game was nicknamed Armageddon. It was the game against Kansas when Kansas was probably had the only good team they've had in the last century, but they were ranked number two in the country. And Missouri was ranked number four, a team led by Chase Daniel and Jeremy Maclin. And that team beat them on a national stage, ended up losing to Oklahoma in the Big 12 championship game. But that was really what put the Pinkel program on the map, that game and that season. 2008, they get back to the Big 12 championship game, but get blown out by Oklahoma in a Sam Bradford team in his Heisman season where they scored 62 points. And I think they broke the all-time scoring record for that year. That was a very good offense. Then you come into 2010 was another really good program where I was actually on that team, and we beat Oklahoma when they were the number one ranked team in the country and started out 7-0 for the first time. Missouri hadn't done that since 1960 when Dan Devine was a coach. And so you've seen him break through some barriers as the coach of Missouri, and everywhere he's gone, he's won. But Missouri at this point in time is not a program that's going to be, say, where Georgia's at, where they're going to win 10 games every year. Georgia hasn't been able to win the big game either. I think they've only won the SEC one time under Mark Frick, if I'm not mistaken. They haven't won the big game either, and they proved that again this past week when a big game against Alabama comes and they get slaughtered. But they're a perennial 10-win team. That's a very good program. And I know you guys don't like to hear that down there, but they are. And Pinkel is probably not there yet. It's probably not a 10-win program every single year. But every 2 to 3 years, they will have a team that can fight for a division title, and maybe every 5 years, they have a team that can fight for a conference title and will be on the national stage. And Pinkel has had three of those teams, really four of those teams, over the past 7 years.
And it's interesting, as you bring up Georgia and other SEC teams, you know, you played for both a Big 12 conference as well as the SEC conference, and a lot's made out of the differences. And I know you've made some comments in the past about them. Now seeing it a little bit in the reflection, Missouri's obviously had a lot of success. Is there a difference in your mind between playing in the SEC and the Big 12, competing in it, or is it more or less the same and a lot of it's just hype?
No, there's a big difference. There really is. And honestly, between the lines, the difference is more the offensive philosophies, and that's changing a little bit. But the quarterback play in the Big 12 has been so much better in recent years. I know there was a good group of quarterbacks coming through the SEC, but really this year there's almost no one, and that's the differences between the two conferences. I've actually gone on record saying I don't think the SEC team gets a team in the playoff this year because of that. There's no quarterback that can really has proven that he can take over a game like you're seeing Baylor do right now. Like you see, even Texas Tech is running up and down the field. Oklahoma's got a guy that can really play. You're just not seeing that out of the SEC schools, who are really still in the running attack. You're seeing some teams go to the spread a little bit, which I think you're actually seeing more with Drew Locke. You're seeing Missouri go back to that Big 12 type spread. There was a lot of short passes on Saturday that's how we went. That's how we did it when I played. I made a career out of running about 6 yards and catching football. And they were trying to go downfield with Matty Mock. with Drew Lock, they're shortening it up a little bit because I think that's more his strength, and he's got a really strong arm, so he can get the ball out quickly. But the signal callers are I just think so much better in the Big 12 right now than in the SEC. And I know the SEC has had some really good quarterbacks over the last 5 or 6 years. And even going back further than that, they have had some guys. But specifically right now, I think that's a big difference in the conferences. And I just played 1 year in the SEC, and we struggled that year. We went 5-7, and it took a little while to get acclimated. We lost a few games, but I think just a few points. I mean, we had Georgia. We were beating Georgia in the fourth quarter in our first SEC game. As a member of the conference, we probably should have beaten Vanderbilt, lost them in the fourth quarter, went down to the Swamp and lost by 7 points to a team that went to the Sugar Bowl that year, and then also Syracuse. So we had a team that was not bad, and we had some athletes on that team. But that same team probably would have had about the same record in the Big 12, just different. You know, the hard thing is, it's like to win in the Big 12, you probably need to score 50. Oftentimes, to win in the SEC, you got to score 30, but that 30 is much harder to attain than that 50 in the Big 12.
Yeah, that's well said. That's well said. And speaking of quarterbacks going to Drew Lock, he obviously did well against a team that, I agree with you, a very, very poor South Carolina team and a porous defense. Is the plan this week, or what is the plan going to be for Drew Lock? Because do they think they're going to be able to hit those short passes when the strength of Florida is a secondary, or what do you think the game plan is going to be to try to get him into the game?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Florida's got the best secondary in the entire conference. They're really good. This is probably the best secondary they've had since 2012. And a couple of those guys are first-rounders. Was it Josh Elam? Was with the Ravens now? And they had some good players. So this secondary is really good. And the thing is about good secondaries, you can it's not like you can't complete passes on them. You just have to be really efficient about how you go about it. Drew Lock was, I think he was 20 for 26 on Saturday against South Carolina, but it was for like 136 yards. He was 20 for 28 for 136 yards. So the passes aren't going anywhere. You know, it's like normally if you see a 20 for 21 for 28, you're looking for 250 yards. And that just wasn't the case. They threw a lot of passes right near the line of scrimmage. They threw some bubbles. They threw some 6-yard passes. But what you also saw out of Drew Lock was the ability to fire a pass in there. And I mean, the ball flies out of this kid's hands. I played with Blaine Gabbert, and I've got the fingers to prove it because they probably need some surgery after all the beating that they took because he had so much velocity on the football. And that's how Drew is when he really wants to put something on the ball. The ball, I mean, it comes out like a cannonball. So that is, he does have that ability, but like you're saying, does he have the ability to fit in a small window like you're going to have to do against Florida? I'm not sure, and it's going to be a really good test.
And we know last week we were surprised the Gators won. You were surprised the Gators won. I know on Twitter you had this pretty funny quick exchange where it's sort of Florida's going to lose to Ole Miss, guaranteed. You know, come on, guys, the second quarter, Florida's definitely going to lose, followed by my favorite, okay, I'm an idiot, Florida doesn't suck. And so, and I think that's actually the phase of probably a lot of Gator fans, even in reality, as we're going through that game. So we know our secondary is good. We also know we have some weaknesses. But what do you think Missouri's maybe keys to this game are going to be for them to be able to win at home? What has to go right for them in this game?
They're going to have to get some turnovers. And I think that's why they beat South Carolina. If you look at the box score, and I'll see if I can pull that up, the yardage, I mean, just the – I was looking at this earlier today. Time of possession was, I mean, almost dead even. Yardage, Missouri outgained South Carolina by 1 yard. You had penalties. I think Missouri had 6 less penalty yards, so that was call that a wash. The difference in the game was South Carolina threw 3 interceptions. Missouri had 0 turnovers, and they won by 14 points. That, to me, used to be a staple of Pinkel's program and has really been something over the previous 2 seasons with the runs to the SEC East division title. They haven't done that this year, and you had 3 interceptions from a quarterback Nunez, who was just tossing it up for grabs. I mean, one of the interceptions was to a defensive end who's a redshirt freshman. So it's not like he was playing a good game. I think his biggest issue, the biggest issue for the defense right now, they're a really good defense. They have a lot of sacks. They have a lot of tackles for loss. They have a great group of linebackers, very athletic, probably the most athletic in the SEC. But they right now, they're not stripping at the ball. And what you used to see over the last probably two seasons is every time a Missouri player would come in contact with any offensive player, he was stripping at the football. There was always, they call it the can opener. You kind of secure the tackle and rip at the arm. And they had so many turnovers because of that. This season, what you're seeing is some good form tackling, aside from the Arkansas State and Connecticut games. but they're not getting any turnovers. They're not getting any fumbles. I mean, you had three interceptions, but a lot of that is due to poor throws. If they don't start ripping at the football and really making a concerted effort to get these turnovers, I don't think they stand a chance against Florida if Florida plays even 80% of the way they played against Ole Miss.
Well, let me ask you about Missouri itself. What's it like being at a home game there? And maybe give me your favorite restaurant there for Gator fans traveling.
Okay, so my favorite restaurant is D. Rose. It's a guy that he used to play at Missouri way back when. And it's off a road called Nifong. If you get in, it's just D-R-O-S-E, D. Rose. R-O-W-E, excuse me. It's phenomenal. And if you go there, you have to get the portobello mushrooms as your appetizer. And that place, it's got a bar scene, and it's probably not the most popular restaurant in Columbia, but I always loved it. That's one place that I went every time I had a chance. Game day experience at Missouri, you know, it's interesting. There was only 66,000 at South Carolina. There was more at the Connecticut game. So I don't know at this point if the Missouri fans are maybe a little bit rejuvenated because they have some hope that with Georgia losing and now playing Florida, that if they win this game, they're back into the race for the East. I don't know if that's going to be the case or not. I think people were really down after winning a 9-6 game against Connecticut, where somehow neither team converted a field goal and the score was still 9-6. And then you lose to Kentucky, and it's just like, I mean, Kentucky could win the national championship and every team would still be like, dude, we lost to Kentucky. It's a basketball school. They suck. It doesn't matter how good they are. You just think it's Kentucky. They're awful. So a lot of fans were down for that. I think there was 69,000 at the Connecticut game and only 66,000 at South Carolina. But when the place is rocking, that place is as good a place to play and to visit as there is in the whole conference. And I can't speak to all the places, but I have been to the Swamp. I have been to Tennessee. Granted, they were not a good football team that year. I've been to South Carolina. I've been to just about every Big 12 stadium. And Missouri, when it is rocking, that place is awesome. They've got their MIZZOU chant that goes back and forth between the alumni side and the student section side. And it'll be homecoming this weekend, too. So we're hoping for a big turnout.
And before we get your prediction on the game, you mentioned some away stadiums you played in. Did you have a favorite away stadium that just really impressed you? You liked the atmosphere, the culture, the game day experience?
You know, all of the SEC stadiums are pretty awesome. That's one thing that I love about Missouri switching to that conference, because football is taken so seriously. It is a religion. It is a way of life. It is something that everywhere you go, you are welcomed, at least by the fans. Maybe during the game it's not super awesome, but at least before the game, everybody's very friendly. It's that Southern hospitality that I think is fake sometimes, but they still have to do it and make you feel welcome. And there was never a time, and as a player, I know it's different, but it was my parents came to all the games, and I had a lot of friends in the stands, and they always, what they said was, and it's just different. You know, it's hard to explain sometimes, but it is just different. South Carolina was awesome, which, by the way, if you get a chance, go Google South Carolina's stadium right now and see the flood. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's underwater.
You can't even see the field.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's incredible what's gone on over there.
Yeah, unbelievable. But that, I think that tells you the state of the program right now too. It's a nice metaphor. And the other, I guess the one. So I played at Texas A&M 3 straight years, and that's probably never happened before in college football. It's sort of ridiculous. We played against them in 2010, and honestly, that was the birth of Ryan Tannehill, because Gerard Johnson was a starter back then. We had a defensive end named Brad Madison that had 3 sacks on Gerard, who just played terrible. We beat them 30-9, I think, and Ryan Tannehill was inserted into the lineup towards the end of the game and never looked back. He's still starting for the Dolphins. We played them there. Then the next year was the shakeup because Nebraska left and Colorado went to the Pac-12. So we played there again because then it became round robin, 10 teams like it is still today. Then we go to the SEC. Of course, Texas A&M also goes, and schedule has it, we go there again. So we won 2 out of 3 there. And even when we got stomped in 2012, Johnny Manziel won the Heisman, and we just got slaughtered. But it was still an awesome atmosphere. The stuff that they do, they march the horses around the field. They've got a lot of stuff going on, and they've expanded it since I've played there. I think it's like 104 or 105,000 people can fit in that place. That place is awesome, and I hate to say this because I can't stand this program, but Nebraska was unbelievable. Everything about the place is terrible, except if you're a player on Nebraska, I remember their defensive was out there, and it was still when they were like claiming the black shirts, of which is long gone. But they're claiming, okay, black shirts are out there. I'm standing as a slot receiver 3 yards. We cut our splits way down close to the tackles because we knew it was going to be loud. I'm sitting 3 yards from our left tackle, and I am screaming at the top of my lungs that the blitz is coming. They're smoking off the edge, and here comes the linebacker. I think it was Levante David now that I'm looking back at it. And he never even turns his head because it's so loud. And Blaine Gabbert just got absolutely ripped. And it's that sort of thing that tells you, man, this has got to be a really cool place to play. They've got 90-something thousand seats in that stadium, packed, and every person is screaming at the top of their lungs.
All right, TJ, let me put you on the spot here and ask for your prediction for this week. What do you think is going to happen in the game?
So I was looking at the Vegas odds this morning, and I think, didn't it come out that Florida was favored by 4?
I believe so.
Have you seen that yet? Okay. So Vegas is usually really close. And I went on record before Matty Mock was suspended saying, if you're going to bet on any Mizzou game this year, first of all, don't bet on the game itself. Just bet the under, because they can't score any points, and the other team is probably not going to score many on the defense. So if I don't even know what the over-under is, but I would still probably bet the under because the defense can – I mean, that Missouri defense can play ball. They've got really good players. And somehow this defensive line can still really play, even after losing. It, for 2 consecutive years, they've lost, I mean, 4 of the top 10 linemen that have probably ever come through the school. You had an All-American in Michael Sam. You had a even the year before that, Sheldon Richardson, 2012, you had a first-rounder at D-tackle. Then the next year, you have Michael Sam and a second-rounder in Coney Ealy, who's still playing for Carolina. And then this past year, you had Marcus Golden, who had a sack this week on Nick Foles going the second round. And you had Shane Ray, who would have been a top-10 pick if he didn't get busted smoking weed the week of the draft. He's playing for Denver, and I think he had his first sack. So you lose all those guys, and you still have arguably the best defensive line in the SEC. So I think that's something to look out for. But a prediction itself – I'm a Missouri alumni, so don't listen to anything I say. I would say Missouri wins 17-13. That's my official prediction that Missouri fans are going to love, and Florida fans are going to say I'm an idiot. And it's fully Homer. That's 100% guessing with my heart, not my head.
What does your head tell you in 15 seconds or less?
My head says Florida just scored 38 points on Ole Miss, who I think may be a pretender, not a contender, but they also just beat Alabama, so Florida probably rolls 27-10.
Okay, good stuff. Well, TJ Moe joining us on the program today. Thanks so much for being with us. You can find him on Twitter at TJMoe28. He's always full of insights and good commentary, so you won't miss out on that one. TJ, thanks again for being with us. We enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, fellas. Anytime. Good luck this year.
Some fun and candid thoughts from TJ Moe That was fun having him on. Let's play a little game here, James. Give me the yardage, passing yardage totals for both Will Grier and Drew Lock.
Will the Thrill, 275. Drew Lock, 150. What do you got?
I'm going to go a little lower on both these guys. I'm going to go about 230 for Will and about 120 for Drew Lock.
How many sacks are we going to have, and how many sacks are they going to have?
I think they're going to get a little pressure on Will. I think that's going to even out some. I think they're going to sack him four times. It's going to be kind of a step back for the O-line. And I think we're going to put a ton of pressure. I'm going to say we're going to have like five or six sacks.
Is it five or is it six?
I'll go six. I'll go big.
I like it. I'm going to go two for them. I think Will gets rid of the ball really quickly. I think he throws the ball on time, so we'll minimize their pressure. I think they will get pressure. I think we're going to get four. I think we'll be in the backfield all day, but I imagine their game plan is going to really be centered around getting rid of the ball very quickly.
That could be true.
Especially after what they watched us do to Chad Kelly.
All right. Well, this has been really great. Thanks to TJ Moe and Kewan Ratliff. Appreciate having them on. And yeah, thanks for listening. Really appreciate it.
And as always, you can check us out on Facebook. It's the Gator Nation Football Podcast. I implored you to join our Twitter, follow our Twitter account so that we can continue to provide you with a guest that you want to hear. So go ahead and hop on and do that. We look forward to returning next Monday with episode 7. You can always get our podcast every Monday from your favorite podcast app, iTunes, Stitcher, etc. Keep the reviews coming. We appreciate it. We're 5-star rated on all the platforms now, thanks to you guys. And we'll sign off. Hopefully the Gators get a big W on Saturday.
See you next week.